besides it's mine. Don't grieve over a song unsung. Here it is, my will's been done. Now I hear shouts, I smell flowers, I feel blind in love, it's ours. And as I pass, I'll hold your hand. Finally this ship will land. In hot teardrops and cold compresses, fever dream of a baby's dresses, thinking of what came before. Lying here, wanting more memories that we were making. All the while, time was taking what he needs. We'll only guess. Hot teardrops and cold compresses.
The future depends on teachers. Every day, teachers are shaping our tomorrows, starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who will make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who will help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who will be the first in their family to graduate college. It all starts with teachers who meet challenges with creativity, who reinvent education for the future, who work towards a school system that lifts up every child, regardless of race, income, or zip code, and who enable the full potential of our students, our communities, and our country. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Shape the future. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
I am lonesome for you, darling. Oh, from me you're far away. In a lonely little cottage, I am waiting day by day. Though you went away and left me, left me alone in this old world. Prove my love to you.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners are aware of the no less destructive for being baseless assault on critical race theory. Just like with affirmative action, where conservatives said steps toward racial equity really means unfair quotas, media took this charge. Steps toward racial equity really means telling white children to hate themselves, and turned it into something some people are saying. While, of course, out of fairness, they'll acknowledge others disagree. Media themselves, they suggest, occupy the intellectually and morally superior center. A new website engages the attack more productively by using critical race theory as a prism to explore the current range of threats to our multiracial democracy and our ability to talk about it. The site's called The Forum. We'll talk with Editor-in-Chief Chris Lehman. Also on the show, between Rupert Murdoch and Elon Musk, who would you prefer preside over what information you can access? It's kind of like being offered a choice between a poke in one eye or the other. If the problem is media outlets with priorities that poorly serve even our aspirations for democracy, and that is the problem, the response is media with different priorities, which we know really only come from having a different bottom line. How can that work? We'll talk about one model with Mike Rispoli of the group Free Press. He's been working with the New Jersey Civic Information Consortium, a new way of thinking about and meeting local communities' need for news. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. There is a lot to do to resist the imminent Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. There's a lot to do, and what we do will depend on what we really stand for and how we talk about it. How not to do that is reflected in The Guardian, whose May 4th story made the potential abrogation of a fundamental human right a story about media. New peak in culture wars. Global media react to Roe v. Wade leak. The prospect of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, Guardian readers were told, has, quote, dominated front pages across the world, with the global media reporting in detail on one of the most polarizing issues in American politics, close quote. Well, the one thing posing as news amidst that reflexive self-regard is wrong. Abortion is not one of the most polarizing issues in this country. A survey from last week shows 7 in 10 people think it's a decision for the childbearing person and their doctor, versus 24% who think it should be regulated by law. As for a federal ban, there is no state in the country in which such a thing garners more than 30% support among the general public. But it's easy to see why you'd be confused on that if all you read is headlines, or worse, headlines about headlines. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The concerted attack on critical race theory is one of the most appalling called shots in recent memory. Right-wing activist Christopher Rufo declared publicly, quote, "The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans," close quote. In the newspaper is not a metaphor here. Media have been the vehicle for this absurd anti-racism campaign, which has achieved devastating traction in a country in which overwhelming majorities, 76% in a recent poll, acknowledge racial and ethnic discrimination as a big, not a past or historic, but a big problem. Right-wingers know they can play a press corps that will seek to normalize whatever they do as representing one pole of a debate they can pretend they're hosting, even as those actions threaten core democratic ideas. All of which makes corporate media the wrong place to talk about the assault on critical race theory and all that it's really about. Into the Breach is a new website primed for launch. The Forum is a daily site of news and commentary published by the African American Policy Forum. AAPF, where I serve as a board member, was co-founded by Kimberly Crenshaw, key expounder of critical race theory. The Forum's editor-in-chief is Chris Lehman, former editor-in-chief for The Baffler and The New Republic, and author of The Money Cult: Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Chris Lehman.
Thank you, Janine. Really happy to be here. And thanks for the great introduction.
Well, as I understand it, while not denying that critical race theory or what's presented as that is under attack, the Forum isn't defining itself as a defense, but more a user of what is, after all, a tool. Is that right?
Absolutely, Janine. Early on in the bad faith attack from the right, it became very clear, you know, when you're locked in a battle with someone who's lying and shamelessly lying, you know, the conventional incremental fact-checking approach is doomed to fail for the reasons you cited in your introduction. So the Forum is meant to be a freestanding proof of concept for people curious about what critical race theory actually is and does. We're not engaged in the doomed effort to call out the defamations and bad faith attacks of Rufo and company. Rather, we're here to insist what is more desperately clear than ever, that the race crisis and the democracy crisis are one and the same. For entirely too long in American political history, political elites on all sides have regarded racial justice as something you can negotiate away in provisional political calculations. We're in this situation now because of that mindset, and the Forum is very much dedicated to demonstrating in real time the disastrous consequences of those kind of calculations.
It's interesting. With some people, it's as if when we center race, we're no longer talking about them. You know, it's like
exactly.
It's like, yes. Oh, you're going to talk about accents, but I don't have an accent. You know,
I know, right? You're talking to a Midwesterner.
Exactly. I'm neutral.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate very much that the Forum is not sort of pitching in as a defense of critical race theory, particularly given that the people behind this assault have made clear they don't know or care what critical race theory is. It's a vehicle for them to attack, you know, Black people and teachers and history and multiracial democracy in general. So I'm kind of wondering, what is a sense of the range of pieces and perspectives that you're looking to include, and what are you thinking of as a kind of cohering principle for the content?
Well, as I was saying, I think the cohering principle is that, you know, we cannot downplay or disregard the white nationalist assault on multiracial democracy, and we have to document it everywhere it turns up. So this week on the forum, we have a great piece by Rafia Zakaria, author of Against White Feminism, on the bombshell leak of the draft opinion by Joseph Alito to strike down Roe v. Wade, and explicitly saying, you know, it has been a racial project to control women's bodies going back even before the founding of the United States, but certainly throughout the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow, that has been front and center. So that's just a timely example. Last week, we had a piece about Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter and how it also reflects what is at bottom a colonialist mindset, wealth conquering literally the terms by which we engage in public discourse and sort of leaving a scorched earth behind.
Well, so it's showing the range of things that you may not have associated with this sort of toolbox of ideas, but in fact, it's useful to apply this prism to.
Yes, absolutely. Again, the race crisis and the democracy crisis are inseparable. And I think to talk responsibly about the fate of our democracy entails always acknowledging the anti-democratic forces in our history and in our political world today are committed first and foremost to sowing racial division and to, as you indicated earlier, propound this, you know, mythic idea of a real America that excludes certain people largely on the basis of skin color, but also gender. Kim Crenshaw also founded intersectionality, which is the analytical tool that insists that you can't separate out race and gender oppression and other forms of oppression. They are all part of one movement, as we're seeing at this moment when the initial attack on CRT in our schools has now metamorphosed into the Don't Say Gay bills, the attack on trans Americans. It is all of a piece, and we have to respond as one movement saying that this is all an attack on our democracy. The Supreme Court opinion is a clarion call, in my view, that we have to organize at the most fundamental levels to stop these unaccountable elite institutions that have spun out of democratic control.
Well, and just on that note, that has been where people see, I think, a huge void on the part of corporate media in the failure to see these things as a coherent front, as a coherent campaign. It was maddening to see how many media just kind of picked up the script they were handed and presented the attack on critical race theory not as an explicit disinformation effort that's aimed at the same dusty racist goals, you know, but presented it as a controversy sprung up organically
right
from the soil of school boards around the country. And that's media telling the wrong story and really fundamentally misrepresenting the scale of things that are going on. And I think when a lot of people complain to FAIR, certainly, about media, what they're looking for is a sense of urgency, of a sense that the chips are down, you know, and that journalists need to pick a side. And what we're getting instead from elite media is, well, you know, some people think black people are inferior, and then other people call those people racists, and why don't both sides just kind of calm down?
Right, right. And as they say on the Sunday shows, we have to leave it there for now, right? I mean, that whole mindset is disastrous in conditions of democratic peril and the conditions we're living through now. We have a major party that is now weaponized by white nationalist ideology and undertook a coup on January 6th of 2021. And yeah, our media, the mainstream media industrial complex, is sleepwalking through this moment, in part because they have institutional investments in treating politics as a game, it is not a game. This is not a drill.
Right.
This is an all hands on deck moment for anyone who cares about the democratic future of this country. And yeah, our media cannot afford to just reflexively both sides something as fundamental as the right to know what our history is and the right to learn and the right to, yes, pursue actual racial equity in our institutions, because it is long past time to do so.
All right. Well, then into the breach, as I say, come new yes. spaces like the forum. We'll look out for it.
Thank you so much, Janine. I really appreciate it.
All right. We've been speaking with Chris Lehman, editor-in-chief at the new news and commentary site, The Forum. Thanks again, Chris, for joining us on Counterspin.
Sure thing. Anytime.
Counterspin listeners understand that the news media situation in this country works against our democratic aspirations. There are so many problems crying out for open, inclusive conversation in which those with the most power don't get the biggest megaphone, leaving the vast majority outside of power to try and shout into the dominant noise or try to find the space to talk around it. It's no surprise, in that context, conversations about how to make a different media system, differently structured, differently accountable, are among the hardest to have. But while corporate media can give the impression that, like it or not, billionaires controlling the flow of information is the only way things can go, that, like a lot of the elite narrative on political possibility, is simply untrue. One project proving that is an effort to replenish and reimagine local news, which listeners know has suffered dramatically in years of media consolidation, in this case in New Jersey. The New Jersey Civic Information Consortium is a first-in-the-nation project using public funding to support more informed communities. Early movers behind the project were the group Free Press, and we're joined now by Free Press Senior Director of Journalism Policy, Mike Rispoli. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Mike Rispoli.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the New Jersey Civic Information Consortium was established in 2018, but the press resources on the website go back to 2016. What is it that happened then?
In 2016, New Jersey was looking to sell some old broadcast public media licenses that it held. And in the selling of those state assets, the state received $332 million. And Free Press Action was doing some work in New Jersey at the time. We were organizing in communities, trying to find ways to have communities partner with local newsrooms, but also hold local newsrooms accountable. And so we were doing organizing around the state and talking to people about the future of local news in New Jersey. And at that time, and you know, there set to receive this windfall from the sale of these TV licenses. And so we thought, hey, what would it look like if some of that money coming into the state was reinvested back into communities to address the growing gaps in news coverage and community information needs? And so with that, we began the idea of what became the consortium, but ran a statewide grassroots campaign called the Civic Info Bill campaign. And that work began in 2017.
Well, I just want to address just that point, because often when you hear about a new project that addresses an old problem, sometimes the vibe is, we've invented something over here. We've created something. Now everybody line up and see if you can get access to this new thing we created. But what you're talking about is a very different model. It's rooted. It grew. The consortium grew from a lot of relationship building, didn't it?
It did. And I think what's really interesting, especially in the case of New Jersey, so New Jersey receives essentially all of its broadcast media from out of state. It's sandwiched between the New York and Philadelphia media markets. And so the state always had a real like long and rich history of hyper local print media. And obviously we all have seen and experienced that have been impacted by the loss of local news especially over the past 20 years, and many communities have never been well-served, even in the, quote, good old days of journalism. There are many communities who were never really well-served by local media.
Right.
And so when we were looking at this windfall that the state was going to receive, we thought, how could we use public funding to not just invest into like local news or to, quote, like save journalism, but instead, what if we use public funding and public money to help rebuild and really transform what local media looks like in the state? How do we leverage public funding to invest in projects that are filling in gaps left by the commercial media market? And public media and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, when that was created, you know, one of its missions was to fill in gaps by the right. left by the commercial media market.
Right.
Those gaps are huge now. They're so much bigger. And especially in a case like New Jersey. And so we thought, you know, this is a reimagining of how public funds can be used to strengthen local news and information. But it's also a new way of doing it, because the Pacific Information Consortium, it's an independent nonprofit that receives public funds and then invests that into new and innovative local news and information projects, especially in communities that have been historically underserved, which include BIPOC communities, immigrant, poor, rural communities, among the least well-served in the state of New Jersey. And so how are we using public funds to address those really long-standing information needs, as well as the communities who have been impacted by the recent loss of local news in the state? And so it's kind of building on this precedent of public media, but also doing it in a much more kind of innovative way that uses state funds to address a community's information needs and really kind of centering community in that process, as opposed to centering the journalism industry or corporate media.
Well, I like the description. I was struck by the description of the consortium on njcivicinfo.org that says that it, quote, funds initiatives to benefit the state's civic life and meet the evolving information needs of New Jersey's communities, close quote. It doesn't say, as you've just noted, it doesn't say newspapers or give money to websites, you know, and that really, you know, we always talk about the fact that a contribution of a news source isn't just whether the reporters are smart or whether the visuals are high tech, you know, that it has to do with its structure, with who supports it and who it's accountable to. And I think it's interesting mm-hmm. that we're talking about information needs. And of course, that includes journalism and media outlets, but that's not the definition.
Absolutely. And I think that what we knew when we began this campaign was that if this was a campaign to bail out the journalism industry, that wasn't a thing that people were going to get behind. That was a thing that we don't even think lawmakers were going to get behind. But instead, really what we talked about was not the woes of one specific industry, but instead we talked about the impact on communities when local news and information is not accessible. And we know from data, when local media is deficient or disappears altogether, it has significant consequences on civic participation. Fewer people vote, fewer people volunteer, fewer people run for public office, fewer federal dollars go to districts where there's no local media presence. Government corruption increases, government spending increases. So there are all these really profound effects on civic participation and the overall health of our communities when local media isn't meeting people's needs. And so we wanted to make the campaign as well as the bill really centered around that, as opposed to giving government handouts to corporate media who contributed so much to the mess that we are in right now and that we're trying to figure out our way out of.
Absolutely. I liked a comment from Columbia Journalism Review back in 2018. Heather Chaplin said that what's so interesting about what was then the New Jersey Civic Information Bill was that it seems to acknowledge in a very concrete way that journalism is not just its own island floating out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, but rather is just one part of a larger interconnected system that supports democratic life. Well, let me ask you, Mike Rispoli, finally to bring us up to this week, because there's new news just from recently. What's the latest?
Sure. So just this past week, the New Jersey Civic Information Consortium, which I'm grateful to be also be a board member of, announced nearly $1 million in grants to projects all around the state, all different types of projects, projects that train community members in the skills of journalism and how to report on their communities, grants to high schools to train student journalists, grants to research institutions to look at community information needs of the state, grants to civil society. Mm-hmm. So people who maybe don't come from a journalism background, but do things like voter engagement or voter outreach and giving money towards civic engagement projects. Again, like with a particular emphasis on communities that have been the least well served by New Jersey media. And what's really exciting is that this round of grants that just went out, we also gave out $500,000 last year. So the consortium is really, even though the bill passed in 2018, it's really only been doing grant making for the past 2 years or so. But we're already starting to see the impact of how public dollars can not just help support these really interesting projects, but it also help our grant recipients to attract philanthropic dollars as well. And so we're actually beginning to see more philanthropy going into local news projects in New Jersey as a result of state funds being used to kind of help get these projects off the ground. And I've been fortunate to be involved in this work, like you said, since, you know, 2016 or 2017, and, you know, always had an idea of the types of projects that the consortium could support. But, you know, looking at the list of grantees now and the really good critical work that they're doing makes me feel like really, really proud of this initiative. And like you mentioned at the top, it's really like a first of its kind in the nation, but we're also beginning to see other states look to the New Jersey model and take up similar legislation where they are. So what we're really hopeful for is that not only will the consortium have an impact with its grant making in New Jersey, but hopefully also inspire other states and maybe even Congress to look at how public funding can support local news and information.
We've been speaking with Mike Rispoli, Senior Director of Journalism Policy at Free Press. You can learn more about the New Jersey Civic Information Consortium on their site, njcivicinfo.org. Thank you so much, Mike Rispoli, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter Extra and to sign up for our Action Alert Network. It's also the place to show support for the show if you are so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Email from school. About the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No. But you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes, But if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, PA at WRCT.org. And now, Pandemonium.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. It's time for another edition of Pandemonium here. It's been a pretty new show. It's going for a few weeks now. Basically, DJs just do whatever they want to do. My name's Bill. I normally do a heavy metal show on Sunday nights called To Evil Have a Human Name. But I'm also very interested in bagpiping. I've been playing myself for a few years. And CMU obviously has a big history of piping. And today on our episode, I have Andrew Carlisle, who's the director of piping here. He's going to talk a little bit about himself and his position and CMU and play a few tunes for us. Welcome to the show, Andy. How long have you been here at CMU for?
Oh, hello, Bill. Yeah, I've been in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon now for almost 12 years, just coming up to the end of the 12th year yet.
Yeah, and how did that all happen? Where'd you start out and how'd you end up here?
Oh, I'm originally from a small village in Northern Ireland called Ballygowan. And when I was 7 years old, I took up the instrument, the bagpipe. And yeah, just kind of took it from there. Ended up, you know, studying with some of the great players in both Ireland and Scotland. And then played with some various bands across the water. And then I was kind of finishing up grad school, and the job at Carnegie Mellon was posted, so I just applied for it, and here I am, I guess, 12 years later, yeah. So 2010 is when I started.
All right, and it's now 2022. You've been obviously enjoying your time here. You really enjoy the piping program here at CMU. You think it's up there with other places in the world?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was actually the first in the world to offer a degree in piping and also the first to offer a master's. It's a terrific institution here. We've got a really good program and a really good student body. The degree program is actually quite small, being that you have to be a very high standard to be admitted to it. But we also have a lot of non-music majors that play the pipes, that come for lessons and play in the band. And we also have the opportunity for first-year students to, you know, just learn the instrument from scratch. You know, so I do a lot of teaching beginners as well here.
And do you get a lot of those kind of students that seem to really, you know, stick with it? Or do you get a lot of people that just come in and the oddity of it maybe, since you don't have as much piping as back home?
I mean, usually, with any musical instrument, there's quite a big commitment as to, like, learning it and, you know, sticking with it and practicing. And sometimes you do get some people that get excited by it, but you know, when they start their academic studies in computer science or biology or whatever it may be, it gets a bit too much and they give it up. But the vast majority do stick with it. I would say there's at least maybe an 80% retention rate from people who start out to versus people that don't stick with it, kind of thing, on the beginner front. And I get students from all over the world. You know, I've had them from pretty much every continent, aside from Antarctica, I guess, yeah.
Maybe someday. And obviously there's the CMU band, which is pretty active, doing a lot of different events. You'll be doing the graduation ceremony soon.
Yeah, for sure. We've got a pretty good pipe band here. The last time the American Pipe Band Championships were held in 2019, pre-pandemic, Carnegie Mellon won, so a pretty high standard of pipe band. And yeah, it's very active in the greater Pittsburgh community. We just finished up a series of five concerts with River City Brass Band, a series called Celtic Connections. We'll be playing at Commencement. We just played a couple of weeks ago at CMU's Spring Carnival. We're at the St. Patrick's Day Parade downtown in Pittsburgh. So yeah, we're pretty active in the community as well.
And then you're also involved with the Pittsburgh Piping Society here, which is something that you and a few other pipers started a few years ago. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago now that we started it. So basically, there were a lot of bagpipers in Pittsburgh, and a lot of them seemed to live in apartments or condos and things like that that they couldn't practice, or they didn't have very many opportunities that they could go and either play with other pipers or play in front of other pipers. So we kind of just formed this as a kind of social club, and basically the format is, it's kind of like an open mic night for bagpipers. So if you want to come and have a tune in front of a supportive, friendly environment, it's a perfect place for people to come along. And we've had it in various different venues throughout the city over the years. But the average kind of crowd we usually get is about 60 people, I think.
And it's based on some earlier piping societies, correct? Including one here in the Pittsburgh area?
That's right, yeah. Unknown to me, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpipe Society, PBS. I'm not sure if they copyrighted the initials or not back then, but yeah, in the late 1800s, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpiping Society. I don't know too much about it, but I've seen records that it definitely existed. It must have kind of, stopped existing at some point in the early 1900s. But yeah, thankfully in the kind of 2000s, I guess, we resurrected it. Yeah, and it's pretty thriving. We just had an evening there last Friday evening in Squirrel Hill, and with a very good turnout, and with at least maybe a dozen pipers that played in that evening, yeah.
If there's anyone listening right now that's not really knowledgeable at bagpiping or anything like that, where should they check? Just check the website for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, Pittsburgh Piping Society will have a Facebook page, and I believe the website's currently under construction, but yeah, we do have a website. But yeah, the Facebook page is pretty active as to like when the next gathering or meeting or performance is going to be.
All right, great. Well, let's get into some music. You mind playing a few tunes for us?
Yeah, sure.
Up first, you're going to play March Strathspey and Reel. You want to tell us a little bit about those tunes real quick before
sure.
you go?
Sure. Well, a March Strathspey and Reel. So first of all, it's a march. So quite from the Scottish military tradition. And the march I'm going to play is The Braes of Castle Grant. The first two parts of it are traditional, and the third and fourth parts were added by a great piper called George Stuart McLennan. A strathspey is a type of Highland dance. The Highland fling is the dance that goes to the strathspey, and the strathspey I'm going to play is called Inverary Castle. And the reel is a traditional reel, just a different type of Scottish dance, a Scottish reel, and the reel is entitled The Rejected Suitor.
All right, great. Well, let's get right into it. Thank you. All right, Andy, that was great. What do you got next? Hopefully it's something maybe, you know, a little faster, a little more party atmosphere.
Sure, well, how about a hornpipe and jig?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, so I'll try a hornpipe and jig, which is, yeah, two of the more lively dances in the Scottish repertoire. The hornpipe's called Jim Tweedy Sea Legs, and it was composed by a New Zealander called John Allan McGee.
That sounds like a very New Zealand type name.
I guess. Well, it's got five parts in it, and apparently it's each of the parts are to represent one of the seas that he had to cross to get to Scotland. And then the jig is a composition by pipe major Donald MacLeod, and it's called Donald Cameron's Powder Horn.
All right, perfect. You've been listening to WRCT. We're coming to the end of this episode of Pandemonium. I've been here speaking and listening to Andrew Carlisle, director of piping here at CMU, and he's got one more piece of music to play, a pibroch, some classical bagpipe music. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this final piece you're going to be doing?
Sure. Well, a pibroch is kind of the classical music for the Great Highland Bagpipe, and it was composed in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. It can be traced back to the 1500s, and it kind of originated on the west coast of the Isle of Skye in a place called Borag by the MacCrimmon family. And so these are very old pieces of music, and it basically consists of a theme, like a melody, and then there's subsequent variations on that melody as you go through the piece. And as you go through the piece, the variations get more technically complex. but they're all based off the original theme. And the piece that I'm going to play is quite a rhythmic piece. It's called The Red Speckled Bull. Now, there's a couple of different stories behind the name. The first is, it's thought to have perhaps been a mistranslation in the Scottish Gaelic, and it was actually supposed to be the Red Speckled Army. So basically the English redcoats, you know, that they're the Scottish clansmen were witnessing at the time. And the other story about the tune is that, well, bagpipe bags are made of leather, and apparently one of the McCrimmons wrestled the bull and killed the bull and skinned the bull and made his pipe bag out of the skin.
Not sure which story is more brutal.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, this is a long piece, so sit back and relax. You've been listening to show Pandemonium. This tune's going to finish off the set, so enjoy and have a good rest of the evening. Thank you, Andy.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Ready for Whiskey Before Breakfast? I am. I'm Mando Richard. Thanks so much for tuning in to Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. We've got a great show today. We'll start off like we always do on the liquored up side of the family. We'll close down actually with a little bit of an extended gospel set. And in between, we'll hear lots of different kinds of music that I know you will enjoy. Well, let's get our liquored up set started, shall we? Wayne Scott's going to tell us that it's the whiskey that eases the pain.
Crush,